Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
It's Here and Now. Hopes appear to be dashed that Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice's trip to the Middle East might bring about a quick end to a little more than 2 weeks of fighting there. International talks in Rome today failed to bring about plans for a ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah militants in southern Lebanon. Secretary Rice, along with Europe and Arab world representatives, did agree that an international force could help end the violence. Meantime, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan harshly criticized Israel after its warplanes bombed a UN post in Lebanon, killing as many as 4 people. Well, joining us now with the latest from Rome is Reuters Bureau Chief Stephen Brown. And Stephen, first of all, when Secretary Rice went to the Middle East on Sunday, there were many who hoped she could help broker a ceasefire. We now know that didn't happen. Why not?
I think it's a clash of expectations over what could come out of this meeting. A lot of the Arab countries taking part, and some of the European countries, had hoped that there would be a call from this meeting for an immediate ceasefire, whereas Condoleezza Rice and Britain had been saying that that was much too optimistic. It takes an awful lot longer than that, that you need to have certain political conditions on the ground before you could get that, and basically that it would take a lot longer than just the 3 hours that this meeting lasted.
Well, and speaking of things that take a long time, I understand that the press conference took 90 minutes longer than anyone was expecting. So what does that tell us about perhaps tension among the participants?
Absolutely. They were all squabbling, according to diplomats who've spoken to us, about the exact wording of a statement at the end of it. And they were arguing basically over whether they could say that they wanted an immediate ceasefire. And it sounds like Condoleezza Rice got her way because they called for, they used the word urgent, and then they also said they insisted that any ceasefire must be sustainable. Basically, the diplomatic meaning behind that is that there's an awful lot more steps to go before they will actually call for a ceasefire. What's likely to happen now is that they'll the Security Council of the United Nations will mull this for a couple of days, and possibly from there will come a call for a resolution calling for an urgent ceasefire. Basically, diplomatic channels take an awful lot longer than certainly the Arab countries who went to the meeting today would have liked.
Well, one thing that seems easy to agree on is that an international force might be able to help keep the peace there. But what conditions would need to be in place for that to happen?
Well, again, the conditions for that happening are not very easy. Basically, the French, who are one of the European countries who would likely take a very big role in such a force, if it were given a UN mandate, say that it would not be their job to disarm Hezbollah. That means that Hezbollah have to be disarmed before a UN peacekeeping force can go into southern Lebanon. Well, who's going to do that? Clearly, the Lebanese army itself is in no position to disarm Hezbollah. The small 2,000-strong UN force that's there at the moment has not, for all the years it's been there, been able to disarm Hezbollah. So it seems that there's a lot of tricky things have to be done before a force can go in. You have to have a ceasefire and this force going in at the same time to monitor that. I think, again, that's something that's going to come out of the Security Council over the next few days.
And also, the UN Secretary General Kofi Annan was, as we reported a moment ago, outraged at an Israeli attack in southern Lebanon that killed as many as 4 UN monitors. And we heard from UN representatives who said that they had contacted Israel 10 times before the bombing, asking them to please stop bombing in that area. What did Annan have to say about that today?
Yeah, I mean, it does appear that they continued bombing even while they were trying to rescue these 4 victims, for whom it was unfortunately too late. Annan basically has angered the Israelis by saying that he believed it was they were targeting this UN position on purpose. The Israeli Prime Minister has come out and rejected this quite angrily, saying that Kofi Annan has no right to say that Israel is deliberately targeting UN positions. So the diplomatic situation has become a little bit worse between the United Nations and Israel just when they're trying to work towards a ceasefire. It really doesn't help the situation at the moment at all.
And so what's the next step here?
Well, I think the next step is that they have to go back to the Security Council. A lot of this talk about whether this meeting today has broken down or failed or not will probably disappear. It was unlikely to expect action that would stop people being killed to come right out of this meeting. Diplomats telling us that the Security Council will, over the next two or three days, actually come up with those practical steps, a step towards towards defining what kind of international force can go there.
Thanks, Stephen. I'm sorry, we have to go. Thanks so much. Stephen Brown is Rome Bureau Chief for Reuters. And there are reports that more than a dozen Israeli soldiers have been killed in southern Lebanon today. Those casualties are the latest in more than 2 weeks of fighting sparked by Hezbollah's capture of two Israeli soldiers. Adam Harmon has a personal interest in the fighting because even though he's an American citizen, he is an Israeli citizen as well and a reserve in the Israeli army. 2 years of military service is a requirement there, but in 1990, Harmon volunteered for more, the grueling training it takes to earn the Red Beret of an Israeli paratrooper. His unit saw active duty in Lebanon and the West Bank and Gaza, and based on that experience, he helped the U.S. Marine Corps train its officers prior to their deployment in Iraq. Adam Harmon writes about his experiences in the new book, Lonely Soldier, the memoir of an American in the Israeli Army. And he joins us from the studios of WFME in Orlando, Florida. And Adam, tell us why you were willing to leave your comfortable life in New Hampshire to go join the Israeli army.
I moved to Israel because I just felt a deep connection to the land. I had the opportunity when I was in high school to travel fairly extensively in America and even abroad. But when I visited Israel as a high school student, I felt that the land belonged to me and I belonged to it in a way that I hadn't felt anywhere else. And so over time, I deepened that connection by other trips, other visits to the country. And so I decided to make my life there. And part of that calculus certainly was that I was going to need to serve, but I didn't go there in order to become a soldier. I went there to build a life and be part of that community.
And what made you decide to go the tougher route? As you say, you could have just gone in and done your time and gotten out, but you decided to become a paratrooper.
I wanted to serve in a combat unit, and particularly with the paratroopers, because I felt that I needed to share the burden along with everyone else. I could have served in an intelligence unit or some other support capacity, but as someone who was a new immigrant to the country, and in a country where security is the primary concern of every day, I felt that if I was going to have a deep understanding of what was going on in the West Bank and Gaza and Lebanon, I needed to experience it myself. One thing to keep in mind that in Israel, since service is mandatory and everyone has to go, it's the connection between the Israeli society and the Israeli military is a little different than in America. For instance, when kids in high school in America, when they're hitting their junior, senior year, they're focused on trying to get into the best school, looking, you know, already starting to think about what kind of career they might want to have. In Israel, those same kids, the most motivated, the best and the brightest of the country, are looking to see what kind of unit they're going to get to. So as a result, in these combat units, you have the best and the brightest of the country serving there. And I felt that those are the kind of people that I wanted to work with. Those are the kind of people that I wanted to serve with.
And also, as you found, the Israeli military culture is different from the U.S. military culture. I was fascinated by the notion that the Israeli military honors those whose actions save lives. They take it for granted that you are going to be brave on the battlefield.
I kind of had that John Wayne-esque thought that that's what made a good soldier, was this brave, solid, stolid kind of person. But in Israel, good soldiers or people who are truly honored aren't the Rambos of the world. They're the people, they're the quiet people who are willing to make a sacrifice in order to save or help their friends.
And in fact, as you point out, if an Israeli soldier feels that an order is immoral, they not only are supposed to disobey it, they are required by law to disobey it.
You see that not just on the personal level, meaning as part of an operation where you're going to conduct an arrest of a suspected terrorist, that there's an understanding that we need to treat that suspect with respect. But it even extends beyond that in the sense of what you're seeing today in Lebanon, that before an Israeli Air Force strike on a town, Israel sends out leaflets for about 2-3 days to warn the civilians in order to leave. And that's something that many people in Israel take great pride in.
Also, that turns the discussion inevitably toward urban warfare. You were very involved in missions there where you were having to go house to house sometimes to find people who were suspected mm-hmm. of terrorist activity. What are your ideas about how American troops might apply some of this to the urban fighting they're dealing with in Iraq?
In America, soldiers are taught to respond to commands. A lieutenant sees a problem, he communicates that down to his soldiers, and they take action. In Israel, soldiers are taught to take command themselves, to think for themselves, and to act without actually responding to direct orders. And that's particularly important in urban environments where decisions need to be made literally in a second.
Adam, I want to ask you about one situation that you describe in the book about when things were not going well within the unit, and the commander, Menachem, sat everybody down and essentially said, okay, what can we do to make this better? And then he listened and he took their suggestions, which raises the question, is this any way to run an army?
What Menachem did, instead of saying to us at a period of time where we were tired, we were starting to have some internal friction within the unit, instead of sitting us down and saying, listen, this is the way it's going to be, and trying to force us to act in a particular way, he sat down and had an open discussion with us to try to understand what the core problems were. And the result of that actual way that he dealt with that situation was to create an even deeper bond between us as a unit. My particular team became actually the most effective unit within our battalion for that very reason.
Well, moving ahead in your story to 2002, there was a second intifada underway. Operation Defensive Shield was underway. You were back in the United States at that point working on your thesis, but you decided to return to Israel. What made you decide to go back at that point?
I went back to Israel because even though I was living and working here in the States, I felt that I still was obligated to serve my country and my adopted country. Israel was under attack by suicide bombers almost every day. And that was because Israel, as part of the Oslo Accords, had pulled back its military from the West Bank. And that made it easier for the suicide bombers, the terrorists, to come through into Israel proper. And for Operation Defensive Shield, the purpose was to put the Israeli military back in the West Bank in order to dismantle the infrastructure, much as Israel is hoping to do now with Hezbollah in Lebanon and Hamas in Gaza. And so I felt obligated to be part of that.
Any desire now to go back?
Without question. It's very difficult to watch the news and to not have an opportunity to participate and to serve. For that reason, I'm in touch with the two units with which I'm associated to see if they've been called up. At this stage, neither unit has been called up, but if they are, I certainly will go.
Well, Adam Harmon, one last question. What do you think the future holds for the Middle East and for Israel?
We will achieve peace. Certainly, it's not going to happen this year. But it may be in this decade. And so I'm hopeful that in the near future that we really will have true peace in the region.
A good hope to have. Hold on to that one, Adam Harmon. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Adam Harmon is author of Lonely Soldier, the memoir of an American in the Israeli Army. Just ahead, animal rights protesters are out to protect Jaws on Martha's Vineyard. And a little later in the program, TV producer Morgan Spurlock gets people to walk 30 days in someone else's shoes. There's more coming up here and now. Mother Nature can make or break a community that depends on tourism. No snow can mean disaster for ski resorts. A rainy summer can cause people to reconsider that trip to the ocean or the lake. Well, how about a monster shark tournament? It's an annual summer event on Martha's Vineyard off the coast of Massachusetts. It took place this past weekend, and for the first time ever, protesters from animal welfare organizations were there. And that has some people on the island concerned. Here and Now's Christina Russo has the story.
Every summer, thousands of people a day ferry over from Woods Hole to the picturesque gingerbread house town of Oak Bluffs. One weekend a year, it's home to the Boston Big Game Fishing Club's Monster Shark Tournament, where hundreds of boats from Boston and beyond set off over 2 days to hunt and kill the water's biggest sharks for cash and prizes. Tara, from Boston, says she'll be joining the crowds to watch the boats come back to shore.
I saw the tournament for a couple of years ago. It is exciting. You go in and they bring the sharks right in. For someone who's never seen a shark up close, it was fascinating. And people love it.
This is the 20th year for the tournament. Last year, ESPN's national coverage of the event showed a massive 1,191-pound tiger shark strung up at the weigh station. A staff member with the Humane Society of the United States saw the footage, which prompted the organization, along with the Massachusetts Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, to protest the tournament this year. Duncan Ross, chairman of the Board of Selectmen in Oak Bluffs, says despite the opposition, he supports the tournament.
Business people want it here because it's a very, very big weekend. It's a bigger weekend for them than the 4th of July. Bottom line, no matter what you do on this island, you depend upon tourism. That is our bread and butter, no matter what we do.
Peter Martell, another big supporter and owner of the Wesley Hotel, the headquarters of the tournament, says he doesn't like the idea of outsiders coming to Oak Bluffs and telling the small community what to do.
Where does it end? I mean, first you can't catch sharks, and then all of a sudden we can't eat fish. Where does it end? You know, we're not cutting down miles of forest and upsetting the spotted owls. The amount of sharks that are taken are very, very small, and there's tons of sharks out there.
The Humane Society staff set up an information table in Oak Bluff Center during the tournament, answering questions of passerbys.
The amount of sharks that these boats are catching out there, I don't think it's that big a deal. If you get that much time, there's a lot more important causes out there you could be spending your time on.
Work on international shark conservation.
The dwindling global shark population is one issue that concerns the Humane Society. Another is the public perception of sharks, an animal which has been on the planet for more than 400 million years.
We're here today because we've find this tournament, which is one of the most visible tournaments in the country, to be a symbol of the fact that sharks generally are getting a bad rap.
Sharon Young is the Marine Issues Field Director for the Humane Society.
People, I think, for years have thought of them in very negative light. They desperately need conservation. Most large shark species have declined by a minimum of 50%, some of them as much as 80%. The tournaments are a problem for us because they're just helping perpetuate the notion that it doesn't matter what happens to sharks. Their lives don't count. We don't need to care.
Greg Scomel is a marine fisheries biologist with the Massachusetts Division of Marine Fisheries. He's not officially associated with the Monster Shark Tournament, but he's been gathering research from it for 19 years. He says it provides valuable information.
The biological samples give us information about the life history of the animals. For example, if we cut open a stomach, we find out what the shark eats. If we take a tissue sample from the reproductive tract, we determine, you know, what size at maturity. But it's through this tournament sampling that we've been able to get these tissues.
On the edge of Oak Bluffs Harbor, hundreds of spectators gather as the sharks are pulled off the boats and strung up to be weighed. Then the tournament staff lay them on cutting boards to be dissected. Organs are visible, blood is hosed away, a long thresher shark tail is paraded around to the crowd for closer inspection.
You know, this does not feel like the old man in the sea to me. This does not feel Hemingway-esque.
Kerry Scott, another town selectman and a lifelong Oak Bluffs resident, opposes the event.
I don't want the vineyard to be thought of as the place where that big shark tournament happens. It doesn't feel like fishing. It feels like killing.
Tournament officials say some of the carved meat is immediately packed away and donated to food banks. Rob Straighten is a fisherman now in his 10th year at the Monster Shark Tournament.
You know, what people forget is that the conservation movement began with sportsmen. We enjoy a resource. We don't want to see it disappear. We protect the resource, the environment. We're very conscious of those kinds of things.
But Tara from Boston, who earlier on the ferry had been excited about the event, was, in the end, disturbed by what she saw.
I'd seen it before, a few years back, but from a distance, and we were up close. And then they brought new shark in, hung it up, and it was alive. It was moving. It was definitely alive, and I had to turn around and leave.
I always thought that they were doing it for the right reason. You know, I bought into all the town loves it. It's good for the shark population, keeps it healthy, good for the economy. And now when I see it, I was like, you know, it's really just for sport. I'll be honest with you, I've definitely changed my mind.
The Humane Society said it also witnessed a live shark being brought to shore. Officials at the Monster Shark Tournament did not return calls to confirm this, but marine biologist Greg Scommel says it's normal for fish to have post-mortem nerve activity. The future of the tournament is uncertain. The Oak Bluff selectmen are considering placing a question about the event on the town election ballot next April. This year's prize catch was a 482-pound thresher shark.
That report from Christina Russo. And this note, Daryl Martini was a unique individual, a Republican, an ardent Roman Catholic, and a gay astrologer. In fact, he was the official state astrologer of Massachusetts. Martini was also known to radio listeners as the Cosmic Muffin. Martini died of cancer yesterday at his home in Saugus, Massachusetts. He and his partner of 33 years, Ed Bozell, were among the first gay couples to get married in the Bay State back in the spring of 2004. Here and Now was there as the couple went to town hall to get their marriage license.
Congratulations.
Well, thank
Cosmic
you.
Cosmic Muffin.
Yeah, very happy day.
Yes, it is a happy day.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Here were these people who were just friends of ours. And then all the people came down out of their offices to congratulate us. I had trouble not crying.
So it's done.
That's Daryl Martini, also known as the Cosmic Muffin on his nationally syndicated radio segments. Martini died yesterday. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes...
After 15 years of civil war and chaos, Somalia seems poised for a new national government. The question is, which of two options might prevail? One is a U.S.-backed transitional government, which has been fragile at best. The other, an Islamic force that has seized control of at least half the country and the capital. Some fear Islamic rule could turn Somalia into a safe haven for terrorists and become an African version of the Taliban. Newsweek correspondent Rod Nordland is just back from Somalia. Rod, welcome.
Thank you.
So tell us, what is at stake here? Is this potentially or perhaps already Afghanistan African style?
Well, it isn't yet, but you have to remember that when the Taliban first took power, they too were initially quite moderate. Like the Islamic Courts Union in Somalia, people greeted them with great rejoicing that they were actually bringing an end to the depredations of these feuding warlords that have run the place into the ground for the last decade.
So tell us a little bit about the Islamic Courts Council. How popular is it? Where did its money come from? How did it win the people's support?
It won their support by a combination of adherence to Islamic values and good behavior on the streets and disarming these militias that had been such a torment to people. For instance, Mogadishu alone had half a dozen major militia groups controlling different neighborhoods. And every time people passed these points, they were subject to taxes or bribes or extortion. And as soon as the Islamic Courts Union took over, these checkpoints all disappeared and this kind of behavior just stopped. And it brought a sense of security for the first time in many years.
And who were its backers? Where did the money come from?
Apparently, most of the money came locally from businessmen. Somalia is a very Islamic society, and they've always had these courts. But what happened is the courts began to organize, and with support from local businessmen who were fed up with the situation, and financing from them, they put together militias, and they kind of joined a coalition of the courts, and that became a kind of unstoppable force. They had the credibility of Islamic law behind them, and when they started getting results, they got more and more support from the community and from the businesses and from people generally. In most cases, they did not have to actually fight the warlords to disarm them. They just gave up and faded away.
Also, there are other players here. How do people there feel about the presence of Ethiopian troops who have been backing, along with the U.S., the transitional government? Because Ethiopia and Somalia, of course, are traditional bitter enemies.
Right, and people are pretty exercised about that. But so far, it's been limited to posturing. Ethiopian troops have come in a little ways, and they've come to the town of Baidoa, which is quite remote from Mogadishu and from population centers generally. They haven't come in big numbers yet, despite some claims to the contrary. The Islamic Courts Union, and they too are playing a very careful game. They initially moved some of their forces close to Baidoa, where the transitional government was, and that provoked the Ethiopians to come in. They subsequently pulled their troops back and avoiding conflict. And what they say is they want to negotiate with the transitional government, and they want to get into some kind of power-sharing arrangement with them.
Do you see the possibility for a larger regional war here, particularly if Eritrea should become involved?
Yeah, well, to some extent, Eritrea is already involved. I mean, they are apparently the source of a lot of the weapons that the Islamic Courts Union have been able to get. So in that sense, they're already involved, and they're involved, of course, because they're a traditional enemy of Somalia as well. And there certainly is the possibility for a very a wide regional conflict. I mean, they've already had two wars between Somalia and Ethiopia, and there's a very large population of ethnic Somalis in Ethiopia, and that has the Ethiopian government worried, and many people in Somalia, and especially the leadership of the Islamic Courts Union, see that part of Ethiopia as rightfully part of Somalia.
And which do you think would be worse from the U.S. perspective, regional war or an Islamic takeover?
Well, an Islamic takeover, but from the Somali perspective, which is worse? And probably most Somalis would say, well, maybe they're a bit too Islamic for our taste, but at least they're giving us stability and peace, and that's what counts most. And I think, you know, most of us in that situation would feel that way too.
You sat down recently for an exclusive interview with the head of the Islamic Courts Union, Sheikh Awais. This is someone who has not given a lot of interviews, and I wonder if you'd put us in the room with you. What was it like being there? What did you make of the man?
Well, I mean, it was exclusive at the time. Since then, he's actually been on a kind of charm offensive, trying to see lots of people. But it was actually surprising because I had done a round of interviews with other Islamic courts leaders, that Sheikh Sharif, who's the more kind of the executive chairman of the Islamic Courts Union, whereas Sheikh Awais is kind of the Ayatollah figure, the spiritual leader, and probably much more important than Sheikh Sharif. But Sharif had put the courts over as a moderate force and plain, saying that they had been misunderstood and misreported and so on. But Sheikh Awais just let it hang out. I mean, he just sort of laughed his way through the interview. He was very amused by questions about his connections with Al-Qaeda, and he made no bones about his support for Osama bin Laden. It was actually kind of a scary performance. He didn't really have any apologies to make for his viewpoints.
Were you surprised when he compared Osama bin Laden to Nelson Mandela?
I was surprised and a bit offended, actually. I mean, I think it's a bit of a stretch to mention the two of them in the same sentence.
Rod, how credible do you think, then, U.S. fears are about his ties to Al-Qaeda?
Well, I think they're fairly credible. I mean, I think there are a lot of people in Somalia and people not connected to the courts who don't believe that they're actually harboring Al-Qaeda refugees and that they're actually involved with Al-Qaeda. But they also say that there's clearly a great deal of sympathy there. I managed to obtain a copy of a propaganda video that the Islamic Courts made, and it has voiceovers from Osama bin Laden and lots of praise of you know, international jihadis and so on. And you know, if they have an opportunity, it looks like that's something that they'll definitely develop, and it could become a real problem in the future.
Do you think the tipping point has already passed there, that this will be an Islamist state?
Yes. There's no chance at all that the transitional federal government will prevail in any way. What they do have is international support, and that's why the Islamic courts have refrained from declaring a government. I mean, they're insisting on negotiating with the TFG because they want international acceptance and credibility.
Well, Rod Nordland, thank you so much for bringing us up to date.
Okay, my pleasure.
Newsweek correspondent Rod Nordland, just back from Somalia. You're listening to Here and Now. Companies searching for future engineers and scientists aren't just recruiting on college campuses. These days, they're targeting students as young as 11 and 12 years old. The demand for employees with math and science skills has never been greater. But U.S. high school graduates rank near the bottom of the pack on math achievement scores. So American companies are spending about $100 million a year to get kids interested in careers in math and science. Marcella Grand is Senior Vice President of Strategy and Corporate Development for Monster.com Worldwide. He joins us on the line from New York City. Marcel, welcome.
Thank you, Gail.
So tell me, middle school students, really?
Hard to believe, right? It's a bit early, but... So let me just set the stage. How did we get to this perfect storm? You've got a slowing workforce, right? You've got 78 million baby boomers in transition. Job demand, as measured by Monster's Employment Index, is up 35 points. Enrollment in key occupations is down in universities. All of this is really, really manifesting itself to create a skill shortage that's becoming a real big problem for companies. They've been spending money in training and reskilling and even taking on eldrepreneurs and moving them back into the marketplace. And now we're getting to the point where some companies like CVS and Johnson & Johnson and Lockheed Martin, hundreds, are really doing some heavy lifting and investing in sourcing. And this means they have to get into the high school markets and the early college markets and create more occupational influence, telling people that, hey, maybe you haven't thought about being an actuary, but here's your chance.
And why do you think kids have not been that interested up until now?
At the crux of it, the ratios of career counselors in the United States due to budget constraints over the last 10 years are definitely down. And this leaves this bell curve of a great group of students that are smart and motivated but don't necessarily have the occupational guidance.
Well, now, many companies, as you certainly know, simply go overseas to places like India and elsewhere and find their engineers and their math and science whizzes. But this is a problem for defense contractors like Raytheon, I understand, because you have to be an American citizen in order to work for a defense contractor. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And what's Raytheon going to do? Just go to Boeing? This is robbing Peter to pay Paul. You know, it's more than just good corporate citizenship or altruism. This is a business imperative that these companies realize if there aren't enough of these skilled individuals, we have to figure out a way of making it. So we term it making labor versus finding labor.
Do you see the kind of problem that Raytheon is facing as a national security issue?
You know, that's a great question. I think that it's going to take planes falling out of the sky for people to say we don't have enough traffic controllers.
And what are the companies that are doing the smartest things, in your view, to solve the problem?
Well, we've seen a couple different approaches, and they all come with some massive investment and a lot of luck. You see, like PricewaterhouseCoopers is doing a tremendous amount of reach out. You've got other companies like Lockheed Martin that have paid apprenticeships for high school students. Many people are familiar with the famous Johnson & Johnson nursing ads that have been fairly prolific in the media.
Are any companies thinking of offering scholarships, or are they actually doing that at this point?
I haven't seen any companies offer scholarships, but we've also seen, though, once you become an employee, back to this issue of training and reskilling, there's a tremendous amount of money being put into companies investing in their workforce. So once you're in the organization, it's not really hard to find tuition remission and maybe not a full scholarship, but certainly some support for ongoing learning.
And Marcel, you mentioned a very interesting term a moment ago about elderpreneurs. So it sounds as if what you're suggesting, that some of these companies perhaps shouldn't be quite so anxious to broom the aging boomers out the door.
Well stated, yeah. 78 million boomers, to be precise, and that's going to have a prolific impact in our labor pool over a period of 20 years. And the smart companies, so we've seen Home Depot, Walmart, these are companies that have really embraced the ability to take people that don't necessarily want to retire. Boomers coming into the marketplace might not want to be in the rat race, but they might want a part-time, flexible, stimulating opportunity at another company. And the smart companies are finding ways to really attract that talent.
I'm wondering if perhaps the company should match the elderpreneurs and the boomers with the middle school students.
That's a great idea. Who better to teach you what the world of business is like than somebody who's been in it for 40, 50 years?
Well, we'll offer that one for free. Marcel Legrand, thank you so much.
Thank you, Gail.
Marcel Legrand is Senior Vice President of Strategy and Corporate Development for Monster.com Worldwide. He spoke to us from New York City. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. Tonight, the FX cable network begins the second season of its runaway hit reality show, 30 Days. The premise, as laid out in the beginning of the premiere episode by its creator, is simple.
Hi, I'm Morgan Spurlock, and in my movie Super Size Me, I explored the issue of obesity by eating nothing but McDonald's for 30 days straight. Over the course of my experiment, I went through a physical, mental, and emotional transformation that was like living somebody else's life. But it got me thinking, what if you could live someone else's life for just 30 days?
Well, in the first season, viewers got to see Morgan and his then-fiancée, now-wife, Alex, trying to live on minimum wage for a month. Other subjects confronted anti-Muslim prejudice and collegiate binge drinking. And the second season promises a host of other hot-button issues. Joining us on the line to talk about what's coming is the creator, executive producer, and narrator of 30 Days, Morgan Spurlock. Welcome, Morgan.
Thanks for having me.
So the first show is taking on an issue that has certainly been under a lot of debate, both in Congress and society at large, illegal immigration. Certainly have
Absolutely.
Great timing there.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those where when you come up with the ideas for the show, you never know how they're going to transpire, you know, in the world around us. And this was originally going to be like the fifth or sixth show in the series, and we bumped it up to being the premiere episode just because of the timeliness.
And how would you describe the premise of this episode?
We explored the issue of immigration by having a border patrolling Minuteman, somebody who has a very strict view of illegal immigration, and he moves in with a family of illegal immigrants who happen to live in Los Angeles.
We want to let you listen in now on a clip where that border patrolling Minuteman, Frank George, is vehemently arguing his position.
No, we're not idiots. We go to the border and we see what's happening. That's why I know I'm not a idiot.
You're going to send 30 million people back to Mexico? Then what? Then where do you go with that? And how are you going to deal with the children of these people? Who suddenly you're going to leave them here? Who are the citizens?
They have to have a revolution in their country. They have to fix their country. I don't want any American blood shed over Mexico.
You're Mexican men have to fight. You're making it once again. You're making it sound like there's 40 of them here, and if we can just straighten out these 40, they're here.
Problems,
that's what I don't get. They're
problems
here.
Are problems. Oh, they're here all right, but problems are problems, and you have to deal with them. That's what it is. Life is not easy.
Over the
Life
course of the 30 days, I think that, while Frank may not, come out of this, he's not saying, great, let's let all the illegal immigrants stay. I think that what has finally happened, and what happens over the course of a lot of the shows, is a face is finally put on the issue. It's humanized. Frank finally starts to discover the humanity in a lot of these people. And vice versa. They see in Frank some characteristics that are very much like their own. I mean, what's interesting about Frank is he is a legal Cuban immigrant. He is a Latino who is out there, preaching against how terrible illegal immigration is. So for them, it was really eye-opening.
Well, and then in the second episode, you have another big hot-button issue, outsourcing. And that features a computer programmer whose own job was outsourced to India. He goes to live with a family there. The son works as a manager for a call center, and Chris applies for a job. And then you show us where he has to pass a test to see if his English language skills are good enough to work in the call center. He has to do a sample call, and I want everybody to hear that.
Thank you for calling. This is Chris. How may I provide you with excellent service today?
Hi, Chris. This is John. I've been trying to get through to you guys for quite some time now.
John, I'm here to help you. I'd like to tell you about an interesting new program called Platinum Membership.
Is this going to take long? I'm just about to go out with my wife and go shopping.
Mr. Summers, we would never want to prevent you from having a lovely shopping trip with your wife.
This whole episode, I think, is really fantastic. I mean, because Chris Jobin, who is such this fantastic fish out of water, he's this big white guy in the middle of India. And in this one scene where he actually, he passes his test, so now he can officially speak English. He can talk like an American to American callers. For me, it's such a comment on kind of what's happening in our world today.
Well, in terms of the people who appear in these episodes, Morgan, are they self-selecting? In other words, are people who are open-minded enough to take part in these shows to begin with the kind that will be changed by their experiences?
Well, I mean, I think that when you start to watch these people, they don't come out of this, I think, doing a complete 180. I think that what has suddenly happened with each person who goes on a journey in 30 days is they start to finally, find a common ground. They start to find a dialogue that the two people can have. And usually, what happens is people agree to disagree. But now they're agreeing to disagreeing, having had the insight of the other point of view, which we rarely get, any of us rarely get.
And one of your own personal journeys is when you go to jail for 30 days. I want to play just a little clip from the beginning where you and your wife, Alex, are talking about what that experience might entail.
I'm a little nervous. I don't really know what to expect.
getting shanked, getting raped.
Oh, can you stop, please?
Those are things to be worried about.
I don't want to do this anymore.
Well, you can certainly understand her point of view on that one, can't you?
Yeah, my poor wife, let me tell you.
Well, in fact, we should probably remind people that she is a vegan chef. She watched you risk your health eating fast food and supersize me, and then she was right there struggling with you to live on minimum wage. You know, you guys are married now. You're expecting your first child, or so we're told.
Yes.
Is there a point where you just don't want to take this kind of risk anymore?
Well, I have a feeling, you know, once the baby's born, Alex has already told me things have to change. You know, because so come December 5th, when the baby's due, I think there'll probably be a slight change, but I don't know how drastic.
Well, if it's like other parents, the first baby changes everything. So.
Right, exactly.
When you were filming in jail, did the prisoners know that you were making a film, or were you just the other guy down there in cell block B33?
Well, I mean, we went in there under the guise of I was just another inmate who had been convicted. You know, I came in with about six other inmates who had been processed in. So, you know, there were a few people who, you know, had seen Supersize Me, not very many. You know, I mean, it was a very limited amount. I don't think, you know, the art house films are making their way around the jail systems right now. But most people had no idea. They thought that the producers were there just making a documentary about prisons.
And what was the hardest part for you being in jail?
I mean, for me, I think the hardest part is just dealing with the monotony. You know, there's no structure. There's nothing you really have to do when you're there. So it is, you know, filling your 19 to 20 hours a day that your cell is unlocked with something that is going to make you feel productive. The days seem 10 times as long. 30 days felt like, you know, 3 months. I mean, it was a very long time. And you're stuck there with your thoughts, your mind, all day long, and that's it.
Well, in thinking about this series, I keep coming back to the old line about you can't judge anybody until you walk for a mile in his moccasins, I think was the original version, or shoes, I guess is the updated one. Do you think it's possible for people to change significantly, if not dramatically, by looking at the world from a very different perspective for 30 days?
I mean, I think people walk away from our show very affected. I think people walk away from our show with an appreciation. And for me, I think that's the key element of 30 Days, the idea of tolerance, that we need to be understanding of others. We live in a society and in a time where the people who get the ink and the people who get the radio time are the people who are on the extreme right or the extreme left, you know, the people who are screaming about how terrible or how great things are. And what we need to realize is that there is a bridge that needs to be built over this silent majority that's in the middle, because that's where most of us live. And I think the show does a great job of doing that.
And is there any one particular reaction that springs to mind? Anybody who called up or wrote in and said, oh, you know, I just never thought about it that way before?
You know, when I look at the Muslim in America episode last year, there were so many people who came up to me after that show aired who talked about how they had never really thought about, you know, just Muslims being Americans, that they always seen them as being like kind of these outsiders in our country. And I think that really affected a lot of people and made them start to see that, you know, we can't just judge someone. We can't, you know, go by snap judgments. We have to really, you know, understand where they're coming from and you know, understand what their history is.
Morgan Spurlock is the creator, executive producer, narrator, and sometime participant in the FX reality show 30 Days. The second season of the show begins tonight. And Morgan, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I am the passenger. And I ride through the city.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Gail Harris. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Gail Harris. Join us next time.